a real privilege for me to serve with them. And it's my privilege to introduce them to you tonight. And please withhold your applause because time's running on until they're all on their feet. Max Peter, who is a General Service Trustee of the United States and Canada. Max? Margaret Carlson, who is a General Service Trustee in the United States.
Margaret?
Dave Cook, Regional Trustee from Southeast United States. Dave? George Gordon, man of many, many, many virtues, many strengths, chairman of our literature committee, chairman of our archives committee, and a very greatly productive person. George? Jim Griffin, regional trustee from Central United States. I shouldn't say anything about these people because I'll turn some of them down, but so it is. Chuck Hansen, our new General Service Trustee from New York and the Grapevine. Bob McPherson, General Service Trustee, who was a great friend of AA. Walter Murphy, General Service Trustee in New York, has been head of our Public Information Committee. Terry Penton, Regional Trustee from Canada. Mike Rainbolt, Regional Trustee from Coast. John Waterfield, Regional Trustee from Washington. Pete Waters, Regional Trustee from Canada. Bruce White, Regional Trustee from Western United States. Stan Wilsey, Regional Trustee from the Pacific Region. These are your AA trusted servants. I'm often asked how you got this way. How come you, a non-alcoholic, are on the Board of Trustees? I don't know how many of you know how that happened. Those of you who don't might get a kick out of it. When the Alcoholic Foundation was first formed, nobody had had more than 3 years of sobriety in AA. And it was hoped that there'd be some money in the picture somewhere. And there hadn't been too much good experience in the money department in AA up to that time. And they thought it might provide some assurance across the world if there were some non-alcoholics on the board. A majority of non-alcoholics on the board. This was changed in 1966. But this is how we have some non-alcoholics on the Board of Trustees. Dr. John Beeler, who is medical director for the Bethlehem Steel Company.
John?
Dr. Vincent Dole, who is a professor in Rockefeller University and who has done a great deal of research in the field of addictions and has been a great friend of AA. Vincent? Austin McCormick, who has been a tremendous support on the board. And a tremendous friend of people in trouble through most of his lifetime. He's a great friend of all of us on the board, a great friend of all of you. And it's been a privilege to work with him. Austin? Milton Maxwell, one of the first really solid interpreters of AA in the professional community. From his early studies and contact with AA groups out in the state of Washington before he came east to work at Rutgers University in the Rutgers School of Alcohol Studies. He is still one of the best interpreters, one of the best communicators of what the strengths are of AA to the professional community. And he's been a great help to all of us on the board. Arthur Miles, who is our treasurer. Worthy successor of Archie Roosevelt, who many of you know. And it's a privilege to have him with us. And our newest non-AA trustee, Gordon Patrick from Canada. And we're looking forward to his strength on the board. Thank you very much. They're a great gang.
I forgot to mention it earlier, so I'd better do so now. For the benefit of any newcomers in our audience this evening, this is the regular Friday night meeting of the Denver Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Ours is one of the larger groups in this area. Well, it's time now. Our introductions have been made. We come to the actual meeting part of our program. Here to chair it is a man whom many of you already know and whom many of you have heard speak before. He has been a toiler in the AA vineyards for many years. I had the pleasure of working with him during his trusteeship and have come to admire and respect his talents and abilities. I'm now going to ask him to step over here and take over this meeting. My good friend and yours, the counselor from Boston, Bill C.
I'm Bill Coogan, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Since this is the regular Friday night meeting of the Denver Group, and we've been here for at least an hour and 10 minutes, and some of you for 2 hours, we will start this meeting by everybody standing up and saying hello to the one next door, to you, behind you, or anything, but just get up off your fannies and relax. You can tell you at an AA meeting there's so much chatter. You're a noisy bunch. Really, to stand up here before you and to look from one end of this vast auditorium to the other, it's awesome. I can think of no other word. And to all of you who are in the arena, how do I look on television? My wife told me to keep this very, very much on a high plane. And I can't help it, because my last name is Coogan, and the Irish have a sense of humor, and I wondered how you liked all the rest of those people marching down here with the fellow with the Irish flag. He said, let it begin with me, but it was in Gaelic. And since I'm four generations removed from Ireland, I don't know any Gaelic. But seriously, when you stop and think of 18,000 people here, gathered in Denver, and look back to the Kiel Auditorium, when the Third Legacy came into being, and our one remaining co-founder turned over the trusteeship to the conference, and the conference being your elected delegates, and you are AA. Had he not turned this back, but turned it over in his wisdom, and it wasn't only his, because he and Dr. Bob had talked on the 12 traditions, and about the 12 traditions, and having them accepted, and the first tradition in particular, which is our common welfare, shall come first, and personal recovery depends on AA unity. And if this isn't an example of AA unity, I don't know what is. Since there are so many people from Texas here, and not all of them ride horses. I know one rides a motorcycle. They get angry if you don't give your date of sobriety and think you're afraid of it. Mine is October 5th, 1957. I didn't say it for that reason. I was afraid of those Texans because I'm going there next month. A chairman is only supposed to really be a timekeeper. And I always say when they ask me to chair a meeting, generally, that if they wanted me to speak, they'd have asked me to be a speaker. But this meeting is composed of three speakers who are to have a half hour. And I was told to use 15 minutes in any way that I chose. So I have taken roughly 10 minutes, leaving 5 minutes for myself for rebuttal at the end, because I have three fine speakers, really. But before I introduce the first one, I would like to find out how many members of Al-Anon are here. Would you raise your hands, please? Beautiful, beautiful. Terrific. I am so glad, because you people were so much sicker than we were. Hold it. I mean that in a different way from which you people took it. We had a reason to be sick. That stuff we put down inside of us made us that way. And the next morning, sick, and sick in the head, and trembling and shaking, and all the fears and everything else. But you people didn't do that. You were living with we nuts. And it must have been horrible. And I am so grateful for you people. You have done so much good. So much good for us, and I'm so proud of you. I don't want to cut that short, the clapping, because it could go on forever, but I want to say something about... I know there are a lot of Alateens here, and God loves them. God loves them. Every time I hear one speak, she just tears my heart to pieces. And I know what they must have put up with. Because I have three beautiful sons. And I know what they must have gone through. And you people, I'm so grateful. So very, very grateful. For returning me, a father, back to those three boys. I told you, three speakers. All of them friends of mine. I've heard them, been with them places. And I admire all three of them. My first speaker is a fellow that I have known for some time. He comes from Saskatchewan, from Prince Albert in Saskatchewan. C.C.
Guess let it begin with me. My name is Cease Corrigal, and I'm from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada, and I'm an alcoholic. A very good friend of mine by the name of Jack Sennon is speaking at Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada tonight. Now, you don't know where Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada is, and you probably don't know Jack Sennon. But that really doesn't matter. But he promised me that he'd mention my name up there if I'd mention his down here. Because of this beautiful program, and because of the many, many people like you people out there, and because of a loving God as I understand him, I haven't had to have a drink since January the 16th, 1952. And we only have a half hour tonight, so I can't tell you anything about my drinking story unless I tell you about the blackout. But I can tell you I'm not here by mistake. I don't come this far by mistake. But I'm here because I drank too much booze and caused myself and a lot of people around me too much heartache. And because one night I was playing poker and a great big fellow that weighed 275 pounds was a little narrow about something I did in a poker game. And I thought he weighed about 118. And he put his big fist in my big mouth. And I landed in hospital. And a little doctor, God bless him, told me that I should join Alcoholics Anonymous. And he brought Alcoholics Anonymous to me, and he brought two fellas to see me. And I got out of hospital, and I had a difficult time getting out of hospital. Because I'm a Protestant, and I was in a Catholic hospital. And I'd given them a bad check for a private ward. And those little Catholic nuns are a little narrow about that. But I phoned my bootlegger and he bailed me out. Because my credit was good with him. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, as I told you, January the 16th, 1952. And I was 27 years of age and I was the youngest member in the whole province, and certainly the youngest member in my group, and it was just beautiful. People patted me on the back, told me I was doing a fine job, and I stayed sober simply by pats on the back. And then a horrible thing happened. Some younger members came in. And they walked right by me, and they went and talked to the older members, And the older members walked right by me and went and talked to the newer members. And there I was out in the middle of the floor, and I was a middle member. And I felt like a hole in a donut. I was nothing. And I had ideas of going back out and trying it again and then coming back in and get all the pats on the back. But thank God I didn't have to do that. For you see, at that time, we had stayed sober by discussing the eighth step, and then the first, and working the first part of the first step, and part of the 12th step where we carried the message. And really and truly, we didn't know too much about this program. And we had a fellow in our group that we asked to chair our discussion meeting. And he told us he would chair it, providing we did one thing. And we said, what is that? And he said, well, we are going to, as a group, go through the steps in sequence. And it doesn't matter who comes into the group, we're not going to go back to step one. We are going to take them by the hand, sponsor them properly, and we are going to do the steps as a group. His name was Ernie Sear. Ernie's now dead, so I break his anonymity. But I love that little guy, and I always will. Because he taught us, and we worked together, and we did the steps together as a group. And that is the experience that I am going to share with you tonight. Up until this time, I had admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. And when we started to go through the steps, I found out that there was a second part to this first step. It said that our lives had become unmanageable. And I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. I hate to even mention the small sum that I owed, because it really doesn't impress people today because of inflation. But I owed $6,200 when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know in the United States and the other countries that's not a lot of money. But back in a little town by the name of Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, that is a lot of money. And in 1952, it was a great lot of money. And I didn't owe it for anything, I just owed it. You see, I got here by way of a poker game. And I had an unmanageable life after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous as far as money was concerned. And I know none of you people out there, all 18,000, you, none of you have had this problem. Whether you're an Al-Anon or Alateen or Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had it. After being in Alcoholics Anonymous for some time, I had a real good job, and my boss got a little sick and tired of the phone calls that he was getting and that I was getting during working hours, and he took me to the bank and he bailed me out, and we paid off the people that I owed money to. And he made me sign a paper that if I ever bought anything again, I would pay cash for it. 3 years later, he bailed me out for $7,500. For you see, I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. But I found out a strange thing, that financial problems has nothing to do with money. Think about that for a moment. It has a lot to do with big-shotism. It has a lot to do with ego. And it has a lot to do with pride. I was the type of a guy, if I owed somebody $40, I wanted to pay them the $40. If I had $38, I would go out and try to make the other two, and I'd lose the 38. And I had problems. And financial problems cost me a lot more money, but it caused me to do many strange things. In Alcoholics Anonymous, where you're supposed to be getting well, it caused me to lie and to cheat and to tell people some horrible, horrible lies. But to show you that I've improved just a little bit, not too long ago, not too many years ago, I owed a manufacturer $10,000. Now, that's not a lot of money in my business because I'm in the fur coat business. But it's a lot of money in the middle of July when it's hotter than it was today. And this manufacturer was writing me some strange letters. And he was making some strange phone calls. And he was talking about padlocks on doors and sheriffs and things like that. And I decided I should write him a letter. And I wrote him a letter and I told him how much I appreciated his merchandise. I told him that I would like fall dating on it. And then I threw a little philosophy at him. I said if I had 10 miles to walk down a railroad track, it would seem like a great distance. But if I was to take it one telephone pole at a time, perhaps it would take a little longer, but I'd finally get there. And I signed it, yours truly, Cecil E. Corgill, manager of the Cecil Corgill Fur Clinic, P.S. I'm enclosing a certified check for $100. And I sent it away. A few days later, I got a letter, beautiful letter. He congratulated me on my letter-writing ability. He suggested that I get out of the fur business and go writing letters for somebody. And he signed it, yours truly, Mo Amsel, Amsel and Amsel, Montreal. Coming through the door now. And he said, P.S., would you mind sending me another telephone pole? I don't owe him any more telephone poles, but I could if I wanted to. And that's what I learned in that first step. But we went on to that second step, and it said, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And now they're telling me I'm crazy. I'd never been to a mental hospital. And so I thought, well, how can I come back from somewhere I hadn't been? And some of the old members took me aside and they said, Cease, it means restore you to sane thinking. And you are really not a sane thinker. As a matter of fact, you are a very negative thinker. And I agreed with them. For you see, I was stupid enough to do what they told me to do. And thank God I was stupid. And I would suggest if anybody in this program, whether you're an Al-Anon, Al-Ateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're real smart and you're having problems, get stupid. Because it helped me. So I found out in step one that I had an unmanageable life, and in step two I found a manager, and that's how simple it had to be. They told me to pray, and I said, who to? And they said, it doesn't matter, just pray. And so I did it. And it worked. But we went on to step three, and they told me that I had to make a decision. I don't know whether you people have any problems with making decisions, but they told me that I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understood him. And I find out, as I rub shoulders with a lot of you beautiful people, that a lot of us have that problem of making decisions. Before I came up here tonight, I was trying to make a decision. I was trying to decide whether I should go to the bathroom or not. And right now, I don't know whether I've made the right decision or not. But in step one, I found out I had an unmanageable life. And in step two, I found a manager. In step three, I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this manager. And I did it this simple. I said, look it, I've done a lousy job. How about you taking charge? And I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's how I did it, and it worked. Talking about simplicity, I have a friend of mine back in Canada that has a ranch. And I like to keep everything simple. And I want to tell you this story why. Another friend, Mr. Amsel's over on that side now. Another friend said, how did you get the name of your ranch? And he said, well, I wanted to call it the Bar Q. My wife wanted to call it the Susie Q. My son wanted to call it the Bar Susie Q. And my daughter wanted to call it the Susie Bar Q. So we called it the Bar Q, Susie Q, Susie Bar Q, Bar Susie Q. And the guy said, that's a terrific name, but where are the cattle? And he said, none of them ever survived the branding. So you see, it doesn't pay to complicate things. So I found out I had an unmanageable life, and I found a manager in step two, and in step three, I turned my will and my life over to the care of this manager. And today I prefer to call God. And then they told me that I had to stop taking your inventory, and I had to start taking mine. that I had to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And they told me that I had to write it down. And they told me the only thing that was tough about step four was getting a pencil. And then they said write down right underneath it that you're a liar. And I had something wrong with me. And I went to page 65 of that big book, and it told me how to take step four. And I made that searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And I had to do it that simple. Just do it the way the book told me to do it, and not argue with it. And then I went on to step five, and it said that I had to admit to God, to another human being, to God and myself, another human being, the exact nature of my wrong. And I found out the only tough thing about step five was step four. After I'd done step four, I found out I wanted to do step five. I also found out that I'd done two-thirds of step five, because I'd admitted to myself and I admitted to another human being, or admitted to God. And now I had to go and to admit to another human being. And I found a little preacher, and I went and talked to him. And I thought I would shake him up, but I didn't. As a matter of fact, he shared a few things with me. He was sort of a little orangutan himself in these times. And I became very fast friends with this man. And I was really proud of myself. For I'd found out that I had an unmanageable life. And I found a manager. And I turned my will and my life over to the care of this manager. And then I went and talked. Went and took my own inventory and wrote it down in a paper. And then I went and talked to another human being. And I was real proud of myself. And then I went to step six. And in the 12 and 12 of step six, the first sentence says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I found that I had to be entirely ready to get rid of all of these defects of character. And believe me, I don't think that I wanted to. Because you see, I was afraid of becoming too good too fast. And if any of you out there are having that problem, don't worry about it. I was afraid of becoming a saint. Don't worry about that either. Because I'm privileged to be doing what I'm doing tonight, many, many weekends, and meeting a tremendous amount of people, and I've never as yet met a saint, not even in Al-Anon or Alateen. But I had to be entirely ready, I found out, and I told you I was stupid, so I went along with that. I was entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And then I had to go on, and I had to humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. And I was a great fellow for telling, humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings. To me, that means humbly prayed to God to remove my shortcomings. And I was one of these fellows that used to tell everybody how to pray. I told him to pray walking down the street, riding in an automobile, riding in an airplane, riding horseback, laying on their bed. But I never, ever told anybody to pray by getting down on their knees, because I hadn't been down there myself since I'd been in Sunday school. But when I was delegate to New York in 57, 58, I think it was, I met a fellow by the name of Shy Walker, and I know some of you people remember dear old Shy. He's now passed away. And Shy told us a story one night at a meeting in New York of how he had a difficult time when he come out of prison of getting down on his knees to pray, and he so much wanted to stay sober. And he told us about how one night he came from work, and he had high-top boots on, and quite by accident, he kicked his high-top boots underneath the bed. And then he told us that the next morning he got down to get his high-top boots from under the bed, and he said, by golly, while I'm down here, I'm going to say a few words. And every night he used to boot his boots under the bed. And the next morning he'd get down there to say a few words. I don't know whether it works with high-top boots or not, but I know that it works with ordinary Oxford, because I tried it. I don't have to do that anymore, because I can pray and get down on my knees. And if there is any definition of humility, to me it's as simple as this. It's the ability to stand and the willingness to kneel. And I learned this through step seven. And then it told me that I had to make another list of all the people I'd harmed and become willing once again to make amends to them all. And I made this list with a pencil and a paper. And I put my own name up top, because I'd lost my self-respect in my own hometown. And I listed all of the other people that I'd harmed, every person that I could remember. And I went on to step nine. And it said, made direct amends to such people wherever possible. except when to do so would injure them or others. And I started to make these amends. And believe me, this is probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me in the AA program. For you see, it allowed me to walk free. I live in a little town, and the main drag is probably a half a mile long. But it used to be about 10 miles long before I made the amends. Because I'd start down the street, and I would see somebody coming that I couldn't meet, and I'd have to go to the other side. I'd see somebody coming there, and I'd have to duck to this side. Then I'd see somebody coming from both sides, and I'd have to go to the back alley. And this is a tough way to live, and it's hard work. And I don't want no part of that. And I started to make these amends, and I made them. And I made amends to people that didn't even know that I'd harmed them. Because I had assassinated a lot of people's character. To build myself up, I had knocked them down. And I had to go and apologize to them. And this is what I had to do in step 9. And I found out that by making these amends, as I said, it allowed me to walk free. And I'll be ever grateful that that beautiful step is in that program. Step 10 is probably the most beautiful step to me because this is a step that allowed me to come back to you people when I'd never been away. After I'd been sober for 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I forgot who I was and what I was and where I'd come from. And I became a Central Avenue big shot. That's our main drag. And I became very interested in material things. And I got some of those material things. But in my great struggle to get them, I once again become spiritually poor, like I was when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never missed any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to every meeting because I went with the wrong motive. I would walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sick thought, something like this. You lucky people, here I am. And I know this will never happen to any of you people, but all I'm doing is telling you that this is what happened to me. And I had a big job, and I got fired from that big job. I went into the office one day with my boss, and I was managing the largest ladies' wear store in the province of Saskatchewan and looking after the fur department for 5 other stores. And we went into this big office of his, and it seems that our store wasn't quite big enough for the two of us. And it seems that he wasn't about to leave. And he fired the great Cease Corrigal. And I walked out of that store with an attitude something like this. Well, they won't last long now. I want you to know that they're still millionaires and they're doing pretty good. But about that time, a great thing happened to me. I had a little cousin from the west coast of Canada. Her name was Fern. She was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and she came to see me. And I don't think that she just came to see me. I believe that she was sent by somebody bigger than us. And she arrived in my city and she found me unemployed. And the year before, I'd written her a letter and told her about all of the big jobs I'd been offered. And she walked into Prince Albert and I'm unemployed. And I was going to a little roundup in the province of Manitoba that coming weekend. And a dear little fellow by the name of Dave Murray from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, who has now passed away, Dave came up to take me to this roundup. And I went downtown and I bought some brand new clothes. And I went down to see my little cousin. And I stood up in front of her in my big egotistical way. And I said, well, kid, how do I look? And she said these few simple words, and I'm going to share them with you. She said, you look real good on the outside, Pete. How are you really on the inside? And I drove with this dear old gentleman, and he didn't talk to me because he knew that maybe Cease was looking at Cease once again. I went into Winnipeg, Manitoba, and I spent 2 days in a hotel room with God, deciding what I should do with my future. And I went back to my hometown, and I went into business for myself. But I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous with the right motive, and I'd never miss any meetings. I started doing institutional work once again with the right motive, and I hadn't stopped doing that. Because that little girl said those few simple words to me. Step 11 to me is probably the step that I am so grateful that I can understand. For it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. The very fact that I can say that is a miracle. The fact that I understand it is a bigger miracle. But the fact that I can take simple prayer and know what it is to me, I don't know what it is to you, but prayer to me is just talking to a loving God as I understand him. Meditation is shutting my big mouth and listening for answers. And that's the way that I understand the first part of step 11. And step 11, I think, is so beautiful because it says praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. I don't know about you people, but sometimes I like to take it back and start running the show again. Not too many years ago, I did that. One of these ladieswear stores that I got fired from come up for sale. And I thought, what a beautiful thing it would be if I could buy this. Get my picture in the paper and on television and radio. The store that I got fired from. And I once again become the owner. And I thought that would be beautiful. And I set up a company, and naturally I was president of the company. We bought the store, and I was manager of the store. And I built the thing up three times to what the volume used to be and went bankrupt. And I don't know whether any of you people have ever gone bankrupt, but I did. I don't know whether any of you have ever gone to bankruptcy court, but I did. And the morning that I was going to bankruptcy court, is one of your new trustees that I sponsored, taught him everything he knows. Max C., the brand new trustee. Not only that, he beat me out, you know. And I'm trying to stand here without any resentment because I thought they should have introduced me tonight. But Max phoned me at 7:30 in the morning I was going to bankruptcy court, and he was laughing on the phone, 600 miles away. And he said, old buddy, I was just thinking something. And I said, what were you thinking? And he said, maybe God decided that you shouldn't be in the ladies' wear business. And he hung up. You don't need people like that when you're going to bankruptcy court. But I believe today that God did decide that I shouldn't be there because I'm pretty happy without being there. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And this step has taught me many, many, many things. Each and every morning, I have a little room in my home where I go in and I read page 86 and page 87 of the big book. I read page 164, page 63, and other parts of the big book. And in page 86, it tells me that I should talk with my rabbi, my priest, or my preacher, and find out some other good literature. And I found this other good literature, and I read that too. And I had a beautiful thing happen to me a few years ago. I have a little granddaughter that lives in eastern Canada. And sometimes when I'm on a trip, something like this, I take my little granddaughter home with me on the airplane. And the first day that she was home, I went in to do my reading in the morning, and she was up. And she knocked on the door, and her grandmother said to her, you can't go in there, Gramps is doing his reading. And she said, well, I have something to tell him. So I said, let her come in. And she came in, and I took her up on my knee, and I tried to explain to her what I was doing. And after I finished, I said to her, now, what did you want to tell me? And she said, I just wanted to tell you that I love you. And I said, well, I want to tell you that I love you, too. I don't know whether that means anything to you, but it means a great deal to me. Because when I came to you beautiful people, I wasn't capable of accepting anybody's love. And I certainly wasn't capable of returning it. But I can with this beautiful little girl. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And I find that power many, 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 many ways. And then it told me in step 12, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, I told you I was stupid, but I figured it out that a spiritual awakening to me was just a personality change. And the very fact that I could have it by going through these 11 previous steps in sequence, I could have it. And I was able to get it by going through those steps. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I would like to share with you a beautiful story about a great actor that was asked to say the 23rd Psalm. And he went home and he rehearsed it in front of the mirror and he rehearsed it on a tape recorder. And he was asked to say it in front of a big audience, something like this. The Sunday before he was supposed to say it, he went to church and he heard his minister say the 23rd Psalm. The great night arrived and this great actor stood up in front of these thousands of people and he said the 23rd Psalm the way any great actor could say it, just beautiful. And when it was all over, he received a standing ovation. He went back up to the microphone and he asked the people to sit down. And he said, I have a favor to ask you. For he says, I have a friend of mine, a minister friend of mine in the audience, and I'd like him to come up here and say the 23rd Psalm. His minister friend came up and said the 23rd Psalm the way it's supposed to be said. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, but he said it from the heart and not just from the mouth. And when it was over, there was no big standing ovation. There were tears in many, many people's eyes. And the great actor once again went up to the microphone and he said, you see the difference between my minister friend and myself is that I know the sheep, but he knows the shepherd. And isn't it beautiful that in our beautiful program that we get to know both the sheep and the shepherd? And let us never forget it, because it's beautiful to know both the sheep and the shepherd. And then it says, we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic that still suffers. All we can do is try. But let's make a good effort. Let's look good when we get the opportunity to try. I once heard a story about a fella that got up one morning and he didn't like the way his wife cooked the eggs or something, and he slammed the door and he went out and he jumped in his car and he went away to work. And he drove down, and he was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he drove down one side of the street and he shook hands at everybody, shook his fist at everybody and he was driving other cars, and he told him to get out of his way, and he'd come to a stop sign. The moment the old green light went on, he'd honk the horn and he just went to work all tensed up and miserable like this. Finally, he got to work and he treated everybody at work the same way. That night he drove home the same way, drove everybody else's car but his own. He got home, he didn't want supper, he went into the television room, he told the kids to turn the television off, he wanted to read the paper. Sorry, I didn't see it. It just went on? I'm real sorry, I didn't see it, Bill, honestly. My time's up. Let it begin with me. Anyway, he went out and he fell asleep in his television room and he got a call to go out on a 12-step call. And he said, why did they call tonight? And he jumped in his car again and he drove it the same way through traffic and cursing and swearing and everybody. Finally, he got to this house where this poor fellow was having trouble. And the poor guy is sick and he's laying on a bed. And the guy sat down beside him and you know what he said? If you want what we have. Who in the hell would want that? And I hope that when we make our 12-step calls that we don't do it that way. I've seen a great amount of unity in this beautiful program this weekend. I've seen so many people working together. And I would like to close with a story about unity. Back in Canada one time, a young couple took their little boy and they went out into a big wheat field. And they were looking at this big wheat field of theirs and their little boy crawled away and became lost. And they looked all over for him and they went and called the neighbors in and they searched and they went in all different directions and they tried to find the little boy and they couldn't find him. And they called the army in and the next morning this army sergeant said, let's join hands and walk across the wheat field. And this way we won't miss them. And they joined hands and they walked across the wheat field. And they found the little boy, and he died of exposure from during the night. And his daddy picked him up in his arms, and he said, why didn't we join hands before? That's what we've been privileged to do. That's what I've been privileged to do. To join hands with you beautiful people and walk in unity with you and with a loving God as I understand him. And I want to thank the committee for allowing me this very beautiful privilege of being with you on this great night in Denver. And I want to close this talk the way that I close every talk that I've ever given. And I hope that it'll help somebody as much as it helped me. Each and every one of you look real good on the outside. How are you really on the inside? Thank you and God bless you.